From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, saving for retirement by getting the most out of your 401k plan. We talk with personal finance writer Mary Rowland about how to decide the amount of money to put in your retirement plan, how to invest the money, and what to do when you change employers. Also, a comic novel that tries to answer the question, why do men often dump women in sudden and mysterious ways? That novel, Animal Husbandry, looks for answers by investigating the sexual behavior of animals. And critic Milo Miles tells us about some great ska reissues by the Scatolites. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Former Democratic Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro has announced a bid to unseat New York Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato.
Senator D'Amato has already signaled what kind of campaign he intends. We see it in his continuing assault on teachers. We saw it with personal attacks on me even before I decided to become a candidate.
Ferraro served three terms in Congress before giving up her seat to be the Democratic vice presidential nominee in 1984. She was the first woman ever nominated by a major party for national office. 6 years ago, Ferraro lost a bitter Senate primary race. There's been a surprise this morning at the opening of the trial of accused Unabomber Theodore Kaczynski in Sacramento. Kaczynski asked to make a statement to the judge, who immediately called a recess to meet with Kaczynski privately. Last month, Kaczynski twice met with the judge in the case in an attempt to fire his attorneys. Kaczynski objected to their intention to use an insanity defense. The lawyers have since withdrawn their notice of intent to use such a defense in the guilt or innocence phase of the trial. As Kaczynski entered the courtroom today, he refused to acknowledge the presence of his brother and mother, who were sitting in the front row. They began crying as he turned his back on them and sat at the defendant's table. The jury in the Terry Nichols trial is expected to begin its deliberations on his sentence after closing arguments today. The jury convicted Nichols of involuntary manslaughter and conspiracy for his role in the Oklahoma City bombing. Now the jury must decide whether he should get the death penalty. Adventurer Steve Fawcett is safe on the ground in Russia after he ended his attempt to become the first person to fly a balloon around the world nonstop. As David McGuffin reports, Fawcett touched down near the coast of the Black Sea this morning.
According to Russia's border guards, American Steve Fawcett's balloon made a soft landing 53 miles northwest of the southern Russian town of Krasnodar. Officials at Fawcett's Mission Control in St. Louis say they have confirmation of this report. The sparsely populated region where Fawcett came down is a marshy territory in between the resort areas of Russia's Black Sea coast and the Caucasus Mountains. Fawcett's trip came to an end due to technical problems, a low fuel supply, and unfavorable winds. Russia's border guards say they got into contact with Fawcett as he crossed the Black Sea. They said he was a welcome, if unexpected, guest. The 53-year-old Fawcett, a Chicago commodities trader, began his attempt at the nonstop round-the-world balloon trip last Wednesday in St. Louis. Despite the failure of his mission, the trip will go into the record books as the second-longest nonstop balloon trip in history. He set the record for the longest last year. For NPR News, I'm David McGuffin in Moscow.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu won narrow approval for his budget in parliament today, but after the resignation of Foreign Minister David Levy yesterday, Netanyahu's government is left with the thinnest of majorities in the Knesset. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 68 points in heavy trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is up nearly 17 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher in very active trading today, as Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Today's advance has been inspired by a drop in long-term interest rates, which fell to five-year lows after Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan suggested over the weekend that lower rates may be needed to combat the effects of falling prices. The market is also being supported by a list of mergers. In the regional phone industry, SBC Communications is expanding beyond the Southwest through the acquisition of Southern New England Telecommunications Corp. at a price of $4.4 billion in stock. And nursing home operator MediTrust Companies is venturing into the hotel industry. The company is buying La Quinta Inns for about $3 billion in cash. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government says construction spending fell 0.9% in November. It's the worst drop in nearly a year. The Commerce Department says spending was pulled down by slumps in commercial and government projects. President Clinton meets with his advisors at the White House in an hour to work on the proposed budget he'll submit to Congress early next month. In a public statement at the start of the session, Mr. Clinton is expected to reiterate what White House officials were saying yesterday on television talk shows, that it's too early to talk about tax cuts. Stock in Netscape is off more than 20% today after the software maker announced that its fourth quarter earnings will be below what Wall Street estimates had been. The company makes one of the leading internet browser programs. Netscape expects to cut its workforce and close some facilities to get back on track. The company expects to post a loss excluding charges of between 15 and 19 cents a share. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If your New Year's resolutions include getting a better grasp on your personal finances and putting money away for your retirement, you'll want to hear what my guest Mary Rowland has to say. She's written a new book called A Common Sense Guide to Your 401k. The 401k is the retirement plan that's replaced pensions in many organizations. It's a tax-deferred savings plan to which the employer and employee contribute money. That money is invested in stocks, bonds, or annuities. Rowland's book is also about the 403bs, which are the counterpart plans at nonprofit organizations. Rowland is a former personal finance columnist for the New York Times and is the author of a previous book about mutual funds. I asked her why more workers now have 401ks than pensions.
Well, when you look at back at the last 10 or 15 years in this country and see how the employment landscape has changed, the 401k is an interesting part of that. They came out right at the beginning of the 80s when employers were looking for ways to cut costs. And as you know, we've seen these huge downsizings or right-sizings, layoffs, whatever you want to call them. And when the 401k plan came out, a lot of employers saw this as a way to shift their costs of providing a pension to employees.
How do 401ks measure up against pensions? Tell me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was with a pension plan, no matter what happened, you were guaranteed a certain amount of money in your pension plan. But with the 401ks, if your money is going into, say, a mutual fund and you're invested in the stock market, the market crashes, you're out of luck.
Well, you're perfectly right, Terry. And beyond that, with a pension plan, you didn't have to put the money in either. Not only were you guaranteed a certain amount, but your employer provided that amount. And it was the employer's responsibility to make sure that it was there for you when you retired. So that was certainly a wonderful benefit for employees. A lot of critics say that the 401k has put far too much responsibility on employees for saving for their own retirement. And there's certainly a bit of truth to that. On the other hand, the 401k gives us a lot more freedom. The pension plan really locked employees into one employer. If you were going to get a full pension, you pretty much had to stick with your employer. With a 401k plan, you could move every 5 years or every 2 or 3 years, and that it's portable. The plan can travel right along with you.
Another freedom or flexibility that you have with a 401k is that if your 401k is in a mutual fund, you could decide what percentage of the money you want to invest in stocks or in bonds or sometimes in annuities. And that's really great if you know something about the stock market. It's kind of daunting if you don't.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think that's where we're getting into what is probably for a lot of people a negative. Not only do we have the responsibility for putting the money in ourselves and the responsibility for putting enough in, but we do have the responsibility for investing it. And I think for a lot of people, this is the first brush they have with investing. You know, a generation ago, most Americans were not investors. And most Americans probably still would not be if it were not for 401k plans. So there's where you really have to do a little bit of research. And employers have been very reluctant to provide advice to employees for fear that it will bring liability with it. If they tell you, you know, Terry, put more of your money in the stock market, and the stock market goes down, they fear that you'll sue them.
Well, we're not going to sue you, so are there any guidelines that financial advisors have come up with to help people figure out how to invest their retirement money, depending on how old they are, where they are in their job growth, how much money they earn, and so forth?
Sure. In my book, I have some sample portfolios that kind of show, depending on your what kind of tolerance you have for risk, how you might divide up your portfolio. But frankly, I think that a lot of these things make it more difficult and, as you say, more daunting than it needs to be. Simpler is always better. And you can make it as simple as just choosing three different investment choices. You know, your employer maybe gives you seven, and you could put divide it just in half in stocks and half in bonds, and that would be a fine diversified portfolio. If you want to learn a little bit more about investing, you can make it more complicated and divide it into, you know, professional investors call these asset classes, like international stocks, some small company stocks, some large company stocks. But I think that it's important to simplify it for people and make them see that you can just put it in two different investments and you'll do fine.
A fear that a lot of people have is that, you know, right now, I think one of the reasons why the stock market has, on the whole, been doing so well is that so many people have money tied up in their 401ks invested in the stock market. So there's a lot of money in the market now. And, you know, people with retirement money tied up in the market can't really take it out even if they want to, in the sense that, you know, it's in their 401k plan. So that's great for the market right now. When, for instance, baby boomers, the bulge in the population, starts to retire and starts to withdraw money from the stock market, is the stock market going to go down? And if so, how is that going to affect other people who still have their retirement money tied up in the market?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation about that, and I think that's probably a bit overblown. There's, as you say, 22 million Americans have, I think, $750 billion in 401k plans. That's a lot of money, and I don't think there's any question that that's been fueling the market over the last several years. However, the baby boomers aren't going to all pull their money out on, you know, January 1st, 2020, or at any particular time. In fact, I don't think people have fully grappled with how demographics are changing the way that people will invest. You know, it used to be that at age 65, when you retired, the advice was move out of stocks. But now at age 65, you might still have 25 or 30 or 35 years to live. So I think as baby boomers learn more about investing, they will see that they need to leave money in stocks into their retirement.
Well, I figure now when there's, for instance, trouble in the Asian markets and they're plummeting and that's having a bad effect on the American market, that people with their money tied up in 401ks and 403bs, money invested in the market, are really worried, because that's, you know, everyone's future is tied up in the market now.
Well, 1997 was a very interesting year. It looked sort of, even at the midpoint, that it was going to be yet another year of double-digit returns. And then in the final quarter of the year, you know, everything sort of fell apart with the problems in Asia and Korea. And yet, I don't think that most investors panicked. In fact, the evidence seems to show that it was the institutional, the big professional investors who were doing all the trading, and that individual investors sort of hung in there. So I do think that investors are learning. They're learning that if they're in for the long haul, they don't need to panic when something like that happens, although there still hasn't been a prolonged period where the market has gone way down or sort of bounced along, you know, gone down 25% and then sort of bounced along at that level. I think that's what really wears people down.
Do you still think that if the market falls in the short term, that in the long term, everyone who's got their retirement money tied up in the market is going to be okay?
That you know, that's what professionals are looking at, that, trying to answer that question every day. I think that people are beginning to sort of digest the idea that if the markets go down and you sell, you've locked in your loss. I mean, that's common sense. It makes sense. It's rational. On the other hand, I think what happens when you see that you've lost 15 or 20% of your money is, if that goes on for a long period of time, you sort of lose the intellectual way of looking at it, and you start looking at it emotionally. And that's where people make their really big mistakes, is, you know, they start looking at it emotionally and saying, I've got to get out and preserve what I have left.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mary Rowland, and her new book is called A Common Sense Guide to Your 401k, and it's about 401k and 403b retirement plans. And it also has advice on how to deal with other money for your retirement. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with financial advisor Mary Rowland, and her new book is called A Common Sense Guide to Your 401k, and it's about retirement money. 401ks force you to save because, you know, usually your employer's putting a certain amount of money into your 401k. Money's deducted from your paycheck every week and put into your 401k. So it's this like mandatory savings plan. And it's great to have a mandatory savings plan because most of us would have trouble saving unless it was kind of done for us. You think that your 401k should really be your first approach to saving money, that it's you know, put extra money in if you can. Why do you say that?
Well, as you've just pointed out, it's the very best way to save and to invest. Yeah, financial planners, professionals always tell us, you know, pay yourself first, save regularly, develop this discipline where you take a certain percent or a certain dollar amount out of each paycheck and put it away. And the 401k does all of those things for us automatically. So there are a lot of reasons that the 401k is our best savings tool.
Now, the money that you put into your 401k is tax deferred. What does tax deferred mean?
Tax deferred, well, maybe we should back up just once and say probably the most important thing is that it's pre-tax. The money that you put in is you're contributing to your 401k plan before you pay taxes. So it's pre-tax money, and then, as you say, it's also tax deferred. And that means that the money and the money that it earns grow without paying taxes until you take the money out during retirement.
So when you take the money out during retirement, are you paying tax money on the profits that you've earned too?
Yes, you are.
So explain to me why this is an advantage.
Well, when if you think about the you know compounding of interest, this is one of the most basic principles, right, of math or economics. When you put money in a savings account or put money aside, it's not just the principal that earns interest, but the interest earns interest, or the earnings earn interest. And so the money grows almost magically. When you don't take anything out for taxes, it can compound much, much, much more quickly. And so it provides just a powerhouse of savings. If someone starts in their mid-20s, for example, they could have $1 million in retirement by saving, you know, an amazingly small amount of money.
What are the regulations surrounding an early withdrawal of retirement money in your 401k?
I think that the biggest reason that most people who don't contribute is because they're concerned that they're locking this money up forever. All of us have lots of competing demands on our money, and especially if you're in your 20s, the idea that you're putting this money away to retirement is very frightening. And in fact, there are a number of ways that you can get it out. The hardship withdrawal, which is perhaps what you're referring to, is a very difficult thing to qualify for. And for the most part, you should just forget about that. You have to be disabled, or the rules are very difficult. And then further, you're not allowed to contribute for a while if you take a hardship withdrawal. But most plans have loans. You can borrow the money. You don't even have to give a reason for it. You can usually make the loan just over the phone. And then the repayment of the loan is just deducted from your check, goes right back into your account, and you pay yourself interest. So that's a very attractive way to get it out.
What are some of the typical mistakes you think people make when it comes to investing in their 401ks?
Well, certainly the first one is that they don't do it, that, you know, not getting the money in there. I tell people that we've just been talking about how to get the money out, and I tell people, if you're worried that you can't get it out, don't think about that. You can get it. You can get it very easily. Just tell yourself that you're going to get it in there. Now we're at the beginning of a new year, and I think you should contribute just as much as you can to your 401k plan. So that would be the first mistake. Contributing enough to get the employer match. The employer, we haven't really talked about this, but most employers match a portion of the money that you contribute. The most typical match is for every dollar you put in, up to 6% of pay, the employer would put in 50 cents. I've seen a recent study that shows that employees are leaving $6 billion on the table by not, you know, capturing that match. So that is certainly the first mistake.
What are some of the others?
I think the second one would be, we talked a little bit earlier about how people should invest. I think employees are still too conservative. They're still worried about, we talked about what happened in the Asian markets last year, and I think people are still a little bit too concerned about seeing the value of their account go down, and so reluctant to invest in the stock market. I think that almost everyone should have at least 60% of their money in stocks, of their 401k money, because this is long-term money that you're going to use for your retirement. And you could put that 60% in a large company U.S. stock fund. That would be the most conservative stock investment. And then the third mistake would probably be, you know, not diversifying. If you put that 60% in stocks, then you want to put the rest of the balance of the money somewhere else. Ideally, I think you would put a little bit in international stocks and a little bit in small company stocks. If you're very conservative, maybe you would put the rest in bonds. And then the next mistake would be, I think, tinkering with it too much. You know, we talk about this as if it's all a mathematical equation or something that you just, you know, you sit down and you decide, here's how I'm going to diversify my money. But in fact, people start looking at it and they say, this is the money that I've earned, that I've worked for. And, you know, maybe the market's going to go down, or maybe the Asian problems are going to spread. And so they start, you know, kind of second guessing themselves and trying to wonder, where should I move now? And that is probably the mistake that causes people to lose the most money, is moving from one investment to another.
What happens if you have your retirement money in a company 401k and then you leave the company?
That's a time you really have to pay attention to. That's one of the times people make their biggest mistake. Whenever you leave your employer, there are tax pitfalls if you don't do the right thing. The money is portable. The money belongs to you, and you can take it with you. But if you don't do it properly, you're bound to lose some of it to taxes. When you leave your job, one of the things you can do is just leave it in your employer's 401k plan. And that's not a permanent decision. I mean, you can leave it there for 6 months, for a year, for as long as you like. And I would encourage people to do that, you know, if they're not certain what else they're going to do with it. The second thing you can do is roll it into an individual retirement account where that protects its tax advantages. The important thing is that you have to have it moved directly from your employer to the individual retirement account without taking possession of it. If the check is written to you, your employer is required to withhold 20% of it. And then once it's in the IRA, of course, you have access to it.
Immediate access, or do you have to wait a certain amount of time?
You have immediate access. I mean, you know, it's taxable. You'll have to pay tax, and you'll have to pay a 10% penalty if you're under 59 and a half. But once you've got it in an IRA account, it's in your name. At that point, you can tap into it whenever you like. Some years ago, when my husband went into business for himself, he elected to take the money from his retirement account and pay the 10% penalty and the tax. He reasoned that he wasn't going to be making a lot of money that year. You know, it wasn't going to boost him into a much higher tax bracket. And he made the decision that it would be worth it to him. And in the long run, he would be better off. You know, he would make more money, and it would be a good investment, sort of investment in himself.
My guest is Mary Rowland. She's a financial advisor whose new book is called A Common Sense Guide to Your 401k. And that's about saving for retirement and planning retirement money. Would you compare for us the 401k and the IRA?
If you were debating about whether to put your money in a 401k or an IRA, a traditional deductible IRA, the 401k would win every time, I think.
Why?
Because you can contribute a lot more. The IRA, all the IRA limits are $2,000, whereas with the 401k, the legal limit is $10,000 this year. You know, different companies have other limits, but it's certainly going to be more than $2,000. The 401k plan almost always has an employer match, which you don't get with an IRA. A 401k plan is what we call a qualified plan, which is another jargony word, but it just means that the Congress looks at it as a tax-qualified plan sponsored by an employer. And that has certain advantages. For example, they're always protected in bankruptcy. If you should file for bankruptcy, the assets in your 401k would be protected. Many states have moved to protect IRAs as well, but that's not universal. And when Congress passes laws, it typically distinguishes between a qualified plan and an IRA. So, for example, if there's a tax-advantaged way of getting your money out of the plan, like we used to have something called 10-year averaging, which was a favorable way to pay your taxes, it applies usually to qualified plans, like your 401k, but if you had your money in an IRA, it wouldn't apply.
Mary Rowland is the author of A Common Sense Guide to Your 401k. She'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about your 401k plan with personal finance writer Mary Rowland. Also, a comic novel that looks to the animal world for explanations of why men suddenly dump women. And music critic Milo Miles considers the current revival of ska, the Jamaican R&B that preceded reggae. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mary Rowland, author of the new book, A Common Sense Guide to Your 401k, which is filled with advice on financial planning for your retirement. There's a new IRA this year, the Roth IRA. What's that?
The Roth IRA is, the limit is the same, $2,000, but it's very different from the traditional IRA in that with a traditional deductible IRA, you put in your $2,000 before you pay tax, and then your everything is taxable when you take it out at retirement. With the Roth IRA, you put in after-tax money. Put in the same $2,000, up to $2,000, but you've already paid taxes on it. But then you never pay tax again. So, although it sounds, you know, if you're debating about it this year in 1998, it sounds better to put the money in pre-tax. The studies show that you will almost always do better letting your money grow without ever paying tax on it again. If you leave the money in for 10 years, all of those earnings are tax-free. There are also some little kind of arcane things with the Roth IRA. For example, when you take the money out, it is not considered taxable income, which is an important distinction for people on Social Security. You know, there are all kinds of rules with Social Security that if your income's in a certain level, your benefits become taxable or you lose part of your benefits. And the money from the Roth IRA doesn't go into that equation. So that could make a really big difference for people on Social Security.
So who would you recommend the Roth IRA for?
Well, I've done some stories on it, and the people that I've talked with say that it works if no matter where you are in your working life, the Roth IRA would be better for you than a regular IRA. In fact, this year, in 1998, you can convert your regular IRA into a Roth IRA if you're income, your family income or your own income is under $100,000. And I think that's going to be a really big personal finance story this year is people are going to be advised to try and get their income within those limits so that they can convert IRAs into the Roth IRA.
And then you pay the taxes on the money you're converting?
You do. And even though you have to pay tax on it, planners, mathematicians, people who run the numbers say that it's so much more advantageous. There are some other little technicalities with it as well. With a regular IRA, you must start taking money out at age 70 and a half, the year after you turn 70 and a half. And there's a whole little cottage industry has sprung up around this because, you know, here people are with probably the most assets that they have anywhere in their 401k, their IRA, their retirement money that they've put aside. And now you have to start taking it out. The rules are so arcane that many people unknowingly get sort of pulled into a method that's not advantageous to them, and then they're stuck with it. With the Roth IRA, you never have to take it out. You can take it out as you like. And that would be that's another really big advantage to it. You also can tap into the money. When the money's been in the Roth for 5 years, you can take it out, provided you don't take the earnings and take only the principal, which I think is really appealing to people. The idea that they can get the money to buy a home or to put their kids through college or something has a lot of appeal.
Mary Rowland is my guest. She is the author of the new book, A Common Sense Guide to Your 401k. And it's a book about planning for retirement and understanding your retirement money. The thought of retirement is really frightening because, you know, to live on retirement money, you need a lot of money. You see estimates of like $750,000. And to think of what it would take to save $750,000, considering what most people's salaries are like now, is positively daunting.
It is. I think that I've been writing about personal finance for a long time, but I'm not really a financial person. I have a master's degree in Russian history, so I came from an entirely different background. And I feel that it's this kind of thing, what you're just talking about, the idea of saving $750,000, that just turns most people off to the whole idea of saving money, of doing their personal finances.
Right. And the idea is like, it's not possible, so why don't
exactly.
I give up now and
exactly.
spend the money?
That's right. I need $1 million for retirement, yeah. $250,000 to put my kids through college, $1 million of life insurance. And, you know, your whole life is just about getting getting these things in place. And I think that you should just forget that. I think you should, you know, put a little money aside for your kids for college, save some money for retirement, have some life insurance. But so many things change and so many different things happen. I tell people in my book that they should think of their 401k money as kind of a freedom fund. You know, don't just think of it that you're putting this money away and you're not going to touch it until you're, you know, old and worried that you're going to be eating dog food. You should put the money away and then you should dream dreams and, you know, think about what you want to do with your life. Do you want to start a business? Do you want to change jobs? This is your money. And I think you should put as much money as you can into your plan, and then you should use it to accomplish what you want to do with your life.
Are you suggesting using it before the age of 59 and a half when you have actual legit access to it?
You know, I guess I am. I mean, I know that's heresy with financial planners, and we keep reading, you know, people don't save enough money for retirement, and I think that's true. I think we need to save money for retirement. On the other hand, when I hear people saying that they're going to retire at age 50, and they spend their whole life up until that point just saving every single nickel, and then they spend their whole life after that just watching every single nickel they spend, it doesn't seem like much of a life, does it? And I think that, you know, if what personal finance does is make us feel that our life is so limited and dreary, that I don't think it's enhancing our life at all. I don't think it's helping us to create the life we want for ourselves. And if you can put money in your 401k plan and then, you know, create a business for yourself and have a life you love, maybe you want to work longer. You know, maybe you, I mean, I think that we need to broaden a little bit the way we think about our life and our retirement.
What do you think we should expect from Social Security?
Gee, I don't have any, you know, scientific reason for saying this, really, but I'm not expecting too much. I don't think it's going to go away, but certainly the trends are in place to keep moving the retirement age up. You know, it's already been moved up to 67 for certain baby boomers, and I think it'll move up to 70. And everything's also in place for taxing benefits of higher income workers, and I think that all those things will continue. So that there'll be something there, but it'll be mainly for people who have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who have no pension, no, you know, like, as you know, many women, because they've worked at different jobs and worked at jobs with no pension system, it will be really almost like welfare, I think.
What do you see when you look ahead to your own retirement? Have you been planning it and thinking about it? Do you have a model of what you want your retirement? Do you even plan to retire?
Well, you know, I don't. This is something that I've talked about quite a lot in my book. I don't plan to retire. I feel that I want to create the life that I want for myself now. I don't want to compromise my working life by putting away every penny for retirement. And I want to have something that I love doing so that, you know, I can keep doing it. I mean, I think ideally, I'm sure everyone feels like this, people would like to have something that they do in their working life that gives them freedom, some freedom to, you know, spend time doing with their family or doing things that they like to do. And then maybe they would like to just do a little bit less and a little bit less of it so that they have a little bit more freedom. But I think most people would still like to keep their mind active and keep doing something they love past some arbitrary age where in the past people retired.
Mary Rowland, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Mary Rowland is the author of A Common Sense Guide to Your 401k, published by Bloomberg. Coming up, a new comic novel about why men dump women. This is Fresh Air. Women, is this a familiar scenario? You meet a guy. He seems to really like you, a lot. You start seeing each other. He's getting serious, and so are you. He even suggests moving in together. And just as you agree, he's gone from your life. You've been dumped. When this happens to the main character in Laura Zygmunt's new comic novel, she looks for explanations in the mating habits of animals, hence the unusual title of this novel, Animal Husbandry. It's Zygmunt's first novel, but it's not her first experience in the publishing world. She worked as a book publicist for a decade. I asked Laura Zygmunt to read from the beginning of Animal Husbandry, in which the main character first lays out her theory of why men dump women, her theory based on the mating habits of bulls and cows.
If someone had asked me a year ago why I thought it was that men leave women and never come back, I would have said this: new cow. New cow is short for new cow theory, which is short for old cow new cow theory, which, of course, is short for the sad, sorry truth that men leave women and never come back because all they really want is new cow. The new cow theory was not my theory, though I renamed it and refined it for my own purposes. The seed of the new cow theory was culled from an article on male behavior which caught my eye, partly because it appeared in a highly reputable newspaper and not in a self-help book with a 23-word title, and partly, too, I think, because of the timing, which was about 9 months after Ray had left me for no apparent reason, and right after I found out that his no apparent reason had had a name all along, New Cow. The New Cow theory was based on several seminal studies cited in the article on the mating preferences of the male cow. First, a bull was presented with a cow. They mated. When the bull was presented with the same cow to mate again, the bull wasn't interested. He wanted New Cow, and this was Old Cow. At which point, the same cow was brought in again, only this time they disguised her slightly, with a hat or little dress. And again the bull refused to mate with her, because he could tell that she wasn't new cow, she was just old cow dressed as new cow. Finally, realizing the bull couldn't be tricked visually, they implemented an ingenious ploy. The old cow was smeared with new cow scent. Smelling new cow, the bull got up and crossed the barn to get a better look. But he was no fool. This wasn't new cow. This was old cow incognito. Old cow in sheep's clothing. Mutton dressed as lamb.
That's Laura Zygmunt reading from her new book, Animal Husbandry. So the main character in your novel, Animal Husbandry, who gets dumped by her boyfriend inexplicably, is based on a relationship you had?
It's based on a composite of relationships that I had and that almost every single woman I know had. I mean, it was the kind of thing that it happens to you once and then you hear the same story, very similar story over and over again, so much so that you start to think you've all dated the same guy. And I think that's what was interesting to me was that, I mean, if it were just sort of an isolated case for me, it would be one thing. But I really, you know, in my misery, I started to, you know, talk to people just because I had nothing else to do. And and everyone sort of, you know, you mentioned the word, you know, dumped, and every, you know, you don't have to pull it out of people. I mean, everyone has a story.
Tell me what some of the patterns were in all the getting dumped stories that your women friends told you.
It seemed that there was a very particular kind of this species of getting dumped, and that was that, you know, you'd be sort of standing there one day and suddenly some guy would just fall in love with you, you know, beg you, pursue you, woo you, court you, etc. And all the women, you know, were sort of like, well, yeah, he, you know, he's nice. And then they were so ardent that the women fell in love with them. And then there's a power shift. And so, you know, the guy would have pursued them, would have begged them. They would have said all the things first. You know, I love you first. I want to live with you, blah, blah. And the woman, you know, falls in love too. And then within, whether it's 6 weeks or 3 months or 6 months or sometimes shorter than that, the guy would panic and leave. And just without sort of explanation. I mean, it wasn't based on, well, we fight too much or, you know, you smoke and I don't, that kind of thing. It just was, you know, 1 minute they're totally head over heels in love with you, begging you to, you know, be in love with them. Then you are, and then they're gone. And this was the particular arc of it that was so interesting, for lack of a better word, and maddening and sort of confusing and all that. And a lot of women I knew had the same experience.
Now, in your novel, Animal Husbandry, one of the warning signs that the woman has that something's not quite right with her new boyfriend is, you know, when they're looking at the new place that he wants to move into with her, he's using all this really flowery language, and he says to her, "My joy knows no bounds." And she thinks, what a really weird thing to say. He doesn't talk like this. Nobody talks like this.
What a dandy.
Yeah, well, how? In what way was that a warning sign? How do you diagnose, "My joy knows no bounds"?
Well, there's just something sort of, I mean, in hindsight, you look at that and you go, what, you know, really, truly, what a dandy. I mean, who talks like that? The person who talks like that is either, you know, a professor of literature, you know, at an Ivy League school, which he wasn't, but, or it's somebody who is so in love with the idea of being in love that they use that kind of language. And I mean, obviously it's not, you know, a hard and fast rule, but that's one of the signals. I mean, if somebody is just so in love with the idea of being in love, then you have to start to wonder, as opposed to the, you know, being really realistic about what it means.
Now, in the novel, the woman in the book falls in love with a man who, after he falls in love with her, I might add, he's already in a relationship. In fact, he's supposed to be getting married to this other woman, but they haven't had intimate relations in a long time. I mean, he seems to have really fallen out of love with her. So the main character in your book is able to rationalize all of this. Well, he doesn't really love her. It's a bad relationship.
Right.
Now, the woman who he was supposed to marry is the assistant director of an abortion clinic during the day, and at night works in a shelter for abused women. Yeah. And so what the main character thinks is, oh, God, she's probably so politically correct. And I'm thinking, what happened to sisterhood? You know, really?
Well,
she has such a negative reaction to the fact that this woman works in a shelter and an abortion clinic.
Yeah, well, I think that's more, in the character's defense, it's more of, you know, it's more of just the competition thing. It's like, well, you know, how humorless can you be if these are your two jobs? I mean, obviously she doesn't have, you know, a personality because she's so good. I mean, she's basically jealous of her that she's a do-gooder and that she's not. But yeah, a lot of times sisterhood does go out the window. You know, a lot of times it doesn't. I mean, I would be nowhere without my closest female friends who I've been very lucky, and my women friends have been unbelievable. On the other hand, every now and then, a woman will date your ex-boyfriend and totally shock you. So, I mean, you just, you know, that happens a lot more rarely, but, yeah. Okay. All right, I'm shamed.
Laura Zygmunt is my guest, and her new novel is called Animal Husbandry. Have you redefined your ideal man as a result of your relationship gone wrong and the research that you did for your new novel?
Mm. I think so. I mean, I'm not sure that it changed because I wrote the book. I think it changes with age and maturity on my part, too. I'll always be attracted to a guy with a washboard stomach, but, you know.
What is a washboard stomach?
A washboard stomach is, you know, abs.
Oh.
Ripples and ripples of abs.
Oh.
You know, how shallow of me. But, I mean, part of what comes with age and maturity in the dating arena is that you, in certain ways, you accept more than you did when you were younger. And in other ways, you will not accept certain things that you did accept when you were younger. I'll accept, for instance, less bad treatment, you know, from a guy than I would have 10 years ago or 5 years ago. On the other hand, I'll accept, you know, a stomach that isn't washboard now. You know, I mean, it's so you change what you're willing to accept. But, I mean, basically, the character traits of men have always been the same. I mean, you know, I want a nice, smart, I don't care what they do for a living, and someone basically who I connect with on a, you know, on various levels.
Not to be obnoxious here, but we know when rippling abs are really important, one shouldn't be surprised if one's made as a narcissist.
You're right. No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, at the time when you're 27 or 26, you don't really know that. I mean, you see the abs and you're like, I'm in love. And of course there's other things to back that. I mean, the person's smart or they're this or they're that. But you have to understand, which is something you don't understand the first time you go through it, that a lot of times you have to really pay attention. I mean, you have to pay attention to what people do and what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times what they say, you know, are just words. And if you let yourself be wooed by flowery, you know, my joy knows no bounds, and you don't pay attention to what they do, if you don't pay attention to the fact that they're cheating on their girlfriend, their fiance to be with you, which they'll do to you, you know, down the road. If they're capable of doing it once, they'll do it to you. It's a fine line to walk after that. I mean, you have to be careful and smart about, you know, who you give your heart to. And on the other hand, you have to not be bitter. I mean, you have to always have a sort of sense of hope that, you know, hope and possibility that love will work. Because if you don't, you'll kill yourself. So it's a very fine line to walk.
Well, Laura Zygmunt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Laura Zygmunt is the author of the new novel Animal Husbandry. Coming up, the ska revival. This is Fresh Air. In the past few years, dozens of young bands have taken up ska, the original Jamaican style of rhythm and blues. Ska faded in Jamaica some 30 years ago, but renewed interest has prompted numerous reissues. Music critic Milo Miles reviews some recent reissues centered on the most influential ska band, the Skatalites.
Ska has undergone two revivals since its heyday in Jamaica. The first was the two-tone movement in the early 80s, mostly confined to England. The second is the ska boom right now, with bands like Sublime, No Doubt, and the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones. Ska's appeal is obvious. It's danceable with a very tough guy sound. Its structure of horns and heavy beats is simple but not simplistic, and it can be twisted into endless variations. Besides, bands with strong, rootsy flavors always get extra points from me. Having said that, I have to add that ska has lost a little grace each time it's come back. More than ever nowadays, ska feels like a fashion to put on. The old Jamaican ska performers knew they were innovators, not a look back. And originally, the music was not just stomping, but swinging, full of tricky jazz inflections. The best way to hear this is to check out instrumentals by the Skatalites. Skatalites were not just a crack instrumental outfit and the house band at Coxon Dodd's hit-making studio. In terms of influence on Jamaican music, the Skatalites were the equivalents of Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives and Hot Sevens in jazz. They laid the foundation and set the standards for everything that came later. And all this from a band that officially lasted only 14 months, from June 1964 to August 1965. A version of the Skatalites records and tours to this day. Of the 9 original members, the standout performers were the 2 tenor sax men, Tommy McCook and Roland Alfonso, and above all, trombonist Don Drummond. Drummond's coherent, passionate solos impressed American jazz masters like J.J. Johnson. But he was already taking medication for mental illness when he stabbed his girlfriend to death on New Year's Day, 1965. He played only sporadically after that and died in an institution 4 years later. On a happier note, the Scottolites recorded so many sides, they must have slept in the studio during their brief existence. More of their work is available than ever before. The collection that shows the Scottolites at their most diverse came out several years ago as Ska Bonanza. It's a double CD, also sold in 2 single volumes. Here we have the Scottolites backing potent singers like Bob Marley and the Wailers and Toots and the Maytals. There's also splinter outfits like Don Drummond and his group in feisty, rare workouts. Dedicated fans are advised to seek out a pair of widely distributed French imports that include later and more well-rehearsed Scottolites numbers. The instrumentals are on an album called Ska, Tribute to the Scottolites. The collection with the band backing up vocalists is called Hog in a Coco. The purest Scottolites of all is on the new double CD set called Foundation Ska, which includes 32 prime sides and excellent copious liner notes. The most poignant track here is an odd tune with heavy roots percussion, Woman a Come. It's sung by Margarita Mahfoud, and yes, that's Don Drummond's girlfriend.
Milo Miles is features editor for Soundstone.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Ayata, your daughter, from Venturian border, a come.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.